You can probably think of an example of someone commenting on a medical matter, someone who doesn't know that much about medicine. It might have been in a political debate, it might have been online, it might have been across the kitchen table from you. See, we all have bodies. It's natural that we care about their use and survival. But people with lots of recognition and little medical training can change the course of a discussion about things that are critical to people's well-being. Those people are the focus of a new book by Paul Offit called Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Paul Offit is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School and the director of the Vaccine Education Center there. In his spare time, he co-invented a vaccine for rotavirus and has written several books. This is a return visit to The Exchange. Dr. Offit visited in 2011 and 2015 to talk about his books Deadly Choices and Bad Faith. Paul Offit, good to have you back.
Thank you.
Certainly a link here between this book and the previous ones. Do you hear much bad advice on vaccines from non-medical people?
All the time. I mean, whether it's celebrities or politicians or activists, they're out there often giving bad advice, which can cause people to make bad decisions for their children, which can cause those children to be harmed. It's really hard to watch.
And they take some risks. And let's start with that concept. As a scientist, do you think you view the concept of risk differently from non-scientists?
That's a great question. I think I work in a hospital, and I see what, I guess I'm biased in the sense that I see what happens when, you know, when children do suffer these diseases. And, you know, because it's a big tertiary care center, it's a 650-bed hospital, there's not a year that goes by where we don't see a child suffer and occasionally die from a vaccine-preventable disease. So that image is always in my head. So when people, you know, say choose not to get an influenza vaccine or choose not to get a measles-containing vaccine or choose not to get a whooping cough vaccine, you know, we see those diseases. So it's always really hard to watch. And yeah, so I think probably as a doctor in a hospital versus someone who doesn't work in a hospital, you do see risk differently.
And speaking of risk, I mean, even before we get to the guts of the book, your dedication mentions lawsuits and death threats. What's been happening to you over the years?
Yeah, well, that's been an unpleasant surprise. I think what I found that I never would have predicted when I sort of just chose to stand up for science was that that I had put myself in the crosshairs of forces who clearly were angry that I was doing that, people who were willing to, you know, send me threatening emails and the occasional death threat. I mean, I've been physically harassed, I've been sued a few times. I mean, the goal is to get me to stop talking, but I have the eye on the prize here is that children are hurt by this bad advice, and so I'm going to continue to do it.
On the lighter side, the prologue of the book starts with a joke and one of my favorites about introverted and extroverted scientists. Can you help us with that one?
Right, it's an old joke. What's the difference between an introverted and extroverted scientist? When an introverted scientist talks to you, he'll stare down at your shoes, at his shoes. When an extroverted scientist talks to you, they'll stare down at your shoes.
So there's a bit of an image of scientists we're working with here.
Right. No, it's true. And I think it's not, you know, I think stereotypes don't come from nowhere. I think as a general rule, scientists are used to working comfortably alone in, you know, concrete blocked windowless rooms inoculating mice for 20 years. I can tell you, I mean, I'm one of those scientists, and it was certainly not preparation for being on the Colbert Report.
Right, which you describe in detail in the book. So that nature of the work and how they are often alone, I mean, how does this end up working against scientists trying to impart information to the general public?
I think the way in which it works against scientists the most is the scientific method. I mean, the scientific method doesn't really allow you to, at least for an epidemiological study, to prove something. So in other words, if you can look at whether one thing is associated with another at a certain level of statistical power. I mean, if I stand on a small chair and jump a few times and flap my arms, I'm not going to be able to fly. That doesn't prove I can't fly. I could try a million times. That would just make it all the more statistically unlikely. And scientists know that. So they really know they can never say never, and so they don't. They'll say, you know, all the evidence to date doesn't support the hypothesis that, let's say, in this case, measles-containing vaccine causes autism. And to some people, it sounds like you're waffling, and worse, to some people, it sounds like you're covering something up. And I think that hurts you in some ways in a public debate, because certainly the other side is often perfectly willing to say in this case, that vaccines cause autism when it's not true.
And this concept that you provide for us later in the book as the null hypothesis is really interesting, because it indicates that even in a field where there often is something like certainty, you know, you get hydrogen and oxygen together in the right conditions, you get water, that there are times when you just simply can't say, well, we don't know that for a fact wouldn't happen ever.
That's right. That's right. You can't say that. And for, you know, for parents get reasonably can say, look, I mean, your studies didn't confirm what I know to be true. I mean, I saw my child was fine, that, you know, they took this medicine, or they took this dietary supplement, or that whatever, and then they weren't fine. This was the problem. I know what I saw. And I'll give you an example. My wife, who's a private practicing pediatrician, walked into the office on a weekend day. She was helping the nurse give vaccines. And so there was a four-month-old sitting on her mother's lap. While my wife was drawing that vaccine into the syringe, the four-month-old had a seizure. While she was drawing it into the syringe, she went on to have a permanent seizure disorder, epilepsy, and actually had died by age 5 of a chronic neurological condition. Now, if my wife had given that vaccine 5 minutes earlier, I think there are no amount of statistical data that would have convinced that mother of anything other than the vaccine caused it. You know, you think I'm stupid? I mean, I will come in here, my child gets a vaccine, 5 minutes later has a seizure, now goes on to have this permanent seizure disorder. I know what I saw. And it's hard to argue that sort of emotional event with statistical data.
Wow. And that particular example, too, is just I can't imagine a single parent who would believe what the story was.
Right. No, I agree with you. Mm-hmm. You know, we're compelled. We're always looking for causes for things. I mean, we are the people who survive the ability to find causes for things, that when we heard a rattle in the grass, that could be something dangerous. We are those survivors. And so we're always looking for causes for things, and that's good to a point. The point being when we sort of falsely assign a cause and then avoid something that could be helpful, I think that's when we hurt ourselves.
Paul, a few seconds before a break here, you speak of an unholy alliance working against the health of all Americans. Is this an organized alliance, you think, or is this...
No, it's not organized at all. I think it's organized only to the extent that often they financially benefit from that kind of stuff. I mean, there's sort of a cottage industry of false hope that surrounds treatments, for example, for disorders for which there aren't clear cures. I mean, like, you know, brain stem gliomas or brain cancers or pancreatic cancers or autism, where medicine really hasn't caught up to that yet. In that sense, there's a coalition, but not otherwise, no.
All right. We'll talk more with Paul Offit about his book, Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Many stories in the book. Paul has appeared on The Oprah Winfrey Show and on The Colbert Report and lots of other places to greater and lesser effect, which he admits in the book. We'll come back and talk more with Paul and take phone calls and emails from you if you'd like to join us when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Paul Offit, MD, Professor of Pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. He's written several books, and he joined us in the past to talk about deadly choices, about vaccine choices, and bad faith about the interventions of religion into medicine. He's back with a new one called Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Paul, you start out by laying out the good and bad in science, things like our lifespans are basically 30 years more than they were about 100 years ago, but then we also have atom bombs. So it seems like through the history of science, there's always been a tension between what we've discovered and our ability to control those discoveries.
Definitely. I mean, you know, we, there are studies that are done, so-called gain-of-function studies, where scientists have the capacity to take a uniformly deadly virus like rabies and alter it so that it's highly contagious, like measles. I mean, so now you would have a combination of a highly deadly virus for which there's no specific treatment that is so highly contagious that it can spread rapidly through the community, which is not true of rabies, right? Rabies is acquired by the bite of an animal, so it's not highly contagious. And so, yeah, we can do things like that. We can make, you know, hydrogen bombs that can destroy. We can save our lives and take our lives away. That's the power of science.
Those gain-of-function studies are the ones that really made my eyebrows go up. I mean, what is the purpose in creating a version of a bug that's more virulent than what exists naturally?
Beats me. what I would say is that you can, in theory, learn certain aspects of, say, virus structure and function, but I think those are dangerous games, and hence the birth of groups like Physicians for Social Responsibility. There are certainly scientists who have banded together. I'm one of them, part of that group, to try and eliminate the ability to do gain-of-function studies. I think there is no value in that and a tremendous amount of danger in that. We put a lot of faith in humankind to say that those kinds of products couldn't be used to do harm.
And we put a lot of faith in people who appear to have great discoveries, as you point out in the book. There's quite a hall of shame in here that, for example, the scientist who won a Nobel Prize for the discoverer of a worm that causes cancer.
Right. And I think that's one point that I thought was important to make in the book, is that there's a difference between science and scientists. And I think the scientific process does ultimately, I think, reveal truths. But scientists get it wrong all the time. I mean, so for example, as you said, in 1926, Johannes Fibiger won a Nobel Prize for discovering a worm called Spidoptera carcinoma that he believed caused cancer, and it didn't. Or Egas Moniz, who was in 1935, was a Portuguese neurologist who invented a surgical treatment for a variety of psychiatric illnesses. He called that leucotomy. When he crossed the Atlantic Ocean, it was called lobotomy, and we performed 20,000 lobotomies in this country as recently as the 1970s, certainly to no advantage. And I think when people hear those stories, they say, see, that's why you can't trust science. But that's not true. I mean, I think we learned that lobotomies weren't what they were claimed to be. We certainly learned that this worm didn't cause cancer. I think actually the most dramatic example is in 1957, Ansel Keys created the heart-healthy diet. He believed that animal fats were bad, that unsaturated fats were good, and therefore butter, which contained animal fats, were bad, and margarine, which was partially hydrogenated vegetable oils, were good, driving us into the waiting arms of trans fats, which probably caused 250,000 heart-related events every year, until we learned that we were better off eating butter. And I think people hear that and they say, see, that's why you can't trust this. But we did learn that. Unfortunately, we learned these things the hard way.
Well, which gets to a central focus of the book, then, or a central point in the argument here, is that so if even the scientists botch things up, why would we trust them and not somebody who says, well, look, I saw this happen to my kid?
Well, I do think truth. I think it's perfectly fine for someone to say, look, this is what happened to my child. My child was fine. They got this measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. You know, 2 months later, they were diagnosed with autism. Could the vaccine have done it? I think it's a fair and reasonable question, but it is an answerable question. You can answer that kind of question in the scientific venues, but by looking at large numbers of children who did or didn't get that vaccine, to make sure that you sort of control for things like socioeconomic background, medical background, healthcare-seeking behavior, so you can isolate that variable, which is what scientific studies are all about, isolating the effect of one variable, in this case, receipt of the vaccine, and are you at increased risk? And the answer to that question has been offered now in more than two dozen studies, and the answer is no, you weren't at increased risk. So fair to ask the question. And then when you create those studies where I think you can safely say a truth has emerged, then the question is trying to get people to believe those studies, to understand those studies and believe those studies. And as scientists, I think we haven't been great at this. I think we've considered it our job to do those studies and then stand back and assume that people will absorb them and believe them. And I think we haven't been great advocates for this, because it's really not our personalities, really, to get out and explain things to the press and to the public. It's not an easy thing to do.
Dr. Paul Offit is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. You talked about how scientists aren't great at talking to the public about things, but then there's a public perception of scientists, too, that we discussed briefly before. But you go into further depth in the book, the idea of the wild hair and the lab coat and the glasses. I mean, does this stereotype ultimately matter?
Yeah, I think it does. I think we see scientists as being somewhat removed from the rest of us. I mean, basic scientists as being sort of, as you said, sort of, you know, the Coke bottle glasses, the white coat, the sort of tousled hair like Albert Einstein, as being a little geeky, nerdy, distant, and in that sense, somewhat removed from us, and therefore more likely to be the inventors or creators of things that are bad. I mean, sort of literal Frankensteins or figurative Frankensteins like Frankenstein, or literal Frankensteins like, you know, genetically modified organisms. And this sort of, I think, is why we don't trust, or at least there's a component of the population that doesn't trust science, because they see them as different from us. What struck me, and I wrote about it in the book, was Aaron Eckhart, who was an actor and played a geophysicist in the movie called The Core in 2003, spent some time with geophysicists and was shocked to realize, and he wrote about this, that these were pretty much just like everybody else, that they got married, that they had children, that they raised those children, that they had to pay bills, and they were pretty much like everybody else. I mean, which is to say, you know, human. And I think that sort of gets lost out there sometimes.
But they're humans in search for a particular kind of truth. I mean, a truth that can be demonstrated and then redemonstrated. You know, they want the things replicated. But there's a great example here of how truth can blur the eyes, because the description where the explanation can be fairly complicated. A great example here is about mercury and vaccines. Two types of mercury, as you point out, which is like, oh, that was like the heavens opened up. Oh, really? Ethyl mercury, methyl mercury? There's a difference here.
Yeah, that was hard. I mean, so in the late 90s, when was born the notion that this ethyl mercury-containing preservative called thimerosal was in vaccines, and a number of vaccines, and therefore, you know, do we really want to be injecting our children with, you know, with mercury, which is certainly a neurotoxin, meaning something that can be toxic to the nervous system? Why are we doing that? Aren't we hurting our children? And that was a complicated explanation. I mean, you had to get people to understand that we're exposed to mercury all the time because mercury is in the Earth's crust. You have far greater levels of mercury in your bloodstream than you're ever going to get from vaccines, but they're at levels well below that. That's what's considered to be dangerous. And, you know, there were 7 studies showing you were at no greater risk of problems if you'd gotten mercury-containing vaccines and if you got the same vaccines that didn't contain mercury. But, you know, explain that. I mean, reduce that into a soundbite. First of all, the word mercury never sounds good. I had to testify in front of congressional hearings where, you know, congressmen would say, you know, when it comes to mercury, I have zero tolerance. Well, if you have zero tolerance to mercury, you got to move to another planet, because on this planet there's mercury. So you have to get people to understand that we have heavy metals in our bodies, like thallium and beryllium and arsenic even, but they're levels well below that's considered to be dangerous. But this is the consequence of living on the Earth's crust, is we're exposed to all kinds of materials, which at high levels could be dangerous, but at low levels aren't. And it's hard to explain that in 15 seconds. You know, to people, you know, who won't understand, who are trying to understand it.
And how did taking thimerosal out of vaccines affect them?
Not at all. It just made them more expensive. I think that, you know, there was a perception that taking them out made them safer, but because they were never, it was never unsafe to begin with, it didn't make them safer. It just made them perceived to be safer, which is obviously a very different thing.
So the issue now is they're shipped out in single dose packages, which just means there's more packaging, and that's the expense.
Right, and that actually can develop, you know, were this to be adopted, say, by the developing world, where, you know, there's far limited resources in terms of what they can spend on vaccines. I mean, were they to have to use single-dose vials, it would be prohibitive to use vaccines. They need multi-dose vials, and if you're going to have a multi-dose vial, you have to have some kind of preservative. And as it turns out, mercury is a gentle bacteriostatic agent, meaning it decreases the ability of bacteria to reproduce themselves. But again, it's just mercury just never sounds good. I think that's what you're up against there.
We're talking to Paul Offit, MD, about what goes on in the world when people take advice from people who don't know the science they're describing very well. His book is called Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Paul is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, director of the Vaccine Education Center there, so very pro-vaccine, very pro-science, and you can join the conversation on the exchange. Your thoughts about what we're talking about or your own experiences to relate here, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you were saying that the mercury story in particular, the ethyl mercury and methyl mercury difference, one gets out of the body faster than the other. Despite the difficulty in saying that in 15 seconds, you say that scientists are good storytellers, Paul.
They certainly have a good story to tell, and I think there are many great science storytellers, Atul Gawande and Richard Dawkins, and I think Stephen Hawking and Jacques Cousteau, I mean, are all great. So, you know, Siddhartha Mukherjee, are all great storytellers. And so we have it in us, and so that's encouraging, and we just have to be able to go out there and do it in an area that's somewhat uncomfortable. I mean, get out of our comfort zone and be willing to talk to people. There certainly are many examples of doing that. Yeah, I mean, Galileo, you know, he observed, you know, the planets, Jupiter, Venus, and he, you know, his monograph wasn't called Planetary Observations or something dry like that. He called it The Starry Messenger. I mean, what a great title. You know, I mean, that's not just that he was observing the stars, they seem to be observing him. You know, and there's many examples of that, of sort of making science popular. I just think we have to continue to push it, especially now. You know, you have a time now, especially when, you know, the administration is a perfect example of this, you know, where people simply declare their own truths. Vaccines cause autism. Climate change isn't real. Evolution is just, you know, just another theory. I mean, you know, the secretary of the Department of Education is a creationist. This should worry people.
So I want to come back for just a moment to the discussion of speaking to groups and getting outside the comfort zone, because you described the most harrowing experience you had speaking to a group, and it was your daughter's eighth grade class.
Yeah, no question about it. You know, she was in the eighth grade. Her teacher asked me if I would be willing to come to her class and talk about vaccines. The entire ride to her school is an all-girls school in suburban Philadelphia. She said, "Don't make jokes, Dad. Kids my age are not going to think you're funny. They don't get old people's jokes." Well, you know, when I gave the talk, it was, you know, I think 19 girls seemed to be enjoying it. One of them just stared grimly forward with a look on her face that said, "Do not embarrass me in front of my friends. I'm not kidding." It was with the most harrowing talk I've ever given. I'm including congressional subcommittees or the Colbert Report. You know, the worst thing that happens there is you embarrass yourself in front of millions of people. But embarrass your daughter in front of her eighth grade friends, and your life is no longer worth living. It was just painful.
It's a great test case. But you described the appearance on Colbert Report. I want to get to Oprah's appearance in just a moment. But just in general, what have you done to sharpen up your approach to make sure that you can get a message across succinctly, and in a polished way?
Well, I think you learn by doing. I mean, I've never had media training, sort of formal media training, but I think the media training you get is just by doing it and watching yourself make, you know, mistake after mistake. But after every time, you sort of learn, you know, what to do differently next time. And so you get better at it. But, you know, it's like anything in life. I think there's some pain in the learning process, so you have to be willing to go through it.
Well, there's an advantage for actors, certainly, because they're used to getting pages full of words and turning them into something that sounds like a human being speaking. So, and I just, that part of it, though, where you get the actors in particular, does it often equate in people's minds to if there's no stardom, there's no celebrity?
Yeah, I think it's
or no
right.
credibility.
I think that's why actors and actresses are so persuasive. Jenny McCarthy is you know, she doesn't have any specific. I mean, she has presumably a child who has developmental delay, and so she's an expert in her child, but she's not an expert. She's not a developmentalist. I mean, she doesn't have an expertise generally in the field, but she's somebody with whom you're somewhat familiar because you've seen her on television or in some movies, or Jim Carrey, because you've seen him in movies. So you believe you know him. You believe you know who he is based on his roles, even though you don't. And certainly neither of them have an expertise in the field, yet we still trust them because we feel we know them, even though we don't. And that's why celebrities sell products, because for the same reason. And they're just selling something here, too.
So, and it's not just the actors and movie stars and that sort of thing, but the work of journalists comes under scrutiny in your book as well. And the big story you provide in here is the elevation of Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, which is going to make a lot of people say, "Who?"
Yeah, so Sherry Tenpenny, I think, is an anti-vaccine physician who, for whatever reason, takes a negative stance on vaccines. And there was a show in Philadelphia sort of looking at a what had then just been a recently developed vaccine against meningococcus, a type of meningococcus, which is a bacteria that can cause meningitis and bloodstream infections and rapid death. And, you know, that episode was called Student Guinea Pigs. And, you know, if you watched that show, you know, you would have had a very, it was in Philadelphia, it was a local show, you'd have been scared by the meningococcal vaccine, even though it had already been tested in about 8,000 people. And, you know, they described this outbreak at Princeton University, and you know, Dr. Tenpenny believed that they were about to be guinea pigs. And there was much data on this. There was certainly very similar vaccine that had been given for decades. So there was a lot of reasons to be reassured. But, you know, the point was to tell two sides of the story, even if one side was supported by the science. The point was to be interesting. The point was, as far as I was concerned, was to sell advertising, because, you know, you sell advertising by being interesting, which means you tell two sides of a story when often it's only one side that's supported by the science, and that's frustrating. I would say the media has gotten much better, at least in the realm of vaccines, they've gotten much better. I think, to some extent, they've been burned, I think, at some level by the anti-vaccine movement and are more a little more suspicious of them.
Back to that point about advertising, though, there was a phrase that I plucked out of the book just for its interest here. The advertising revenue is the ultimate conflict of interest. For whom?
Well, for the people who are benefiting from the advertising sold. So whether it's a newspaper, a radio show, or certainly television, I think there's much more pressures on television to get the advertising revenue. So that is the conflict. So therefore, the goal is to be interesting. I mean, once there was a show on Dateline NBC that looked at the hepatitis B vaccine, and, you know, it basically claimed that the hepatitis B vaccine caused sudden infant death syndrome, that the hepatitis B vaccine caused multiple sclerosis, caused rheumatoid arthritis. And that wasn't true. There are studies done showing that that wasn't true. Nonetheless, that was their story. And I ran into a producer a few months later, and we had a discussion about this, which got a little heated as we went on. But, you know, I was just angry that they were unwilling to show data that exonerated that vaccine. And, you know, and basically at the end, she realizing that I wasn't getting it, that I was too naive, said to me, look, and I quote, our job was to be interesting. If it also happens to be true, great. And that was a sobering moment, that often interest is sacrificed for truth.
Ouch. You write about journalism jail, which is not real, but also about vaccine court, which is. What is vaccine court?
Right. So in the mid-80s, vaccines were under siege by personal injury lawyers. There was a ton of lawsuits, so much so that it really wasn't worth it anymore for pharmaceutical companies to make vaccines. We almost lost vaccines for American children in the mid-80s, associated primarily with a whooping cough vaccine, which certainly had a difficult side effect profile, but not quite as difficult as was being made out in court. And so really it gave birth to something called the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act in 86, which included something called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, to reasonably and fairly compensate children who were hurt by vaccines. And so I think that really sort of stopped the bleeding and then allowed, American children to still receive vaccines. Absent that program, I think we would have not had vaccines in this country.
But does the existence of the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program reward linking unrelated events as cause and effect?
It does. I mean, I think it also rewards linking causative effects. I mean, vaccines, like any biological product, can have negative side effects. So, and I think the program certainly includes those negative side effects. Sadly, it also includes side effects that really aren't consequence of vaccine. They tend to overcompensate. But you could argue, if you're asking this country to vaccinate large numbers of children, better to overcompensate than undercompensate.
Paul Offit, our guest on The Exchange, his book, Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. Back on The Exchange with Dr. Offit and you in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Dr. Paul Offit is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School and the director of the Vaccine Education Center there. He's written several books about science and popular views of science, and including Deadly Choices and Bad Faith, for which he joined us on The Exchange previously. His latest is called Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. The stories of how one actor with a child who is sick and a compelling story can outweigh the work of thousands of scientists and medical professionals. Join us on The Exchange, 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Getting a couple of emails here that I'll get to in just a moment, but you do list a bunch of things, Paul, that sway our thinking: social media, religion, politics. I mean, it seems like there are many more chances to be wrong than to be right.
Yeah, I think that's right. I feel sorry for the consumer, really. I think there's such a dense thicket of confusing information out there. It's hard to work your way through it. The internet is a perfect example, because the internet is a source of great and awful information. And, how do you sort out which is which? And, how do you know who to trust and who not to trust? I think that's really hard. I try and go through this in the book a little bit. I generally think one should trust, certainly physicians who have experience and expertise, or scientists who have experience or expertise in a particular subject. I think generally you're going to be better off there. I think generally you're better off looking at websites that aren't trying to sell you something, usually because that's generally a bad sign. So the CDC or Harvard has excellent healthcare advice, or, the Mayo Clinic. So there are certainly good websites out there. I think our website here at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia for vaccines is informative. But, it's hard. I think it's really hard. And, we believe now that we can know everything we need to know by talking to friends or looking on the internet, when that's hard, because it's hard often to acquire expertise or experience just by reading something online.
You mentioned a couple of sites. I wonder what your thoughts are on WebMD, because that seems to be the one that people refer to first. It's certainly got a nice, tight name.
Yeah, I think WebMD or Medscape are generally good. So I think I give it a generally good sort of 4 out of 5 stars. Again, because they're sometimes the more popular websites or websites that are trying to be popular can sometimes err on the side of sort of popularity as distinct from scientific fact. But I think generally good.
All right. So now back to Jenny McCarthy, who we mentioned has a child who appears to have some developmental issues that she thinks is linked to a vaccine and has gotten a lot of publicity for. You appeared on Oprah with Jenny McCarthy. How'd that go?
No, actually, I was asked to be on the show.
Asked to be on the show.
Yeah,
okay.
I chose not to go. I thought it was a difficult setup in which one could get information. I mean, initially when I was asked to be on the show, I thought, you know, here's a chance to calm the waters. Jenny McCarthy believes that her son's autism was caused by a vaccine. I felt I probably knew more about vaccines than Jenny McCarthy or Oprah Winfrey, but that's really not what that show is about. I mean, Oprah is there to tell a story. Her stories have three roles: the hero, the victim, and the villain. Jenny's the hero. Her son is the victim. This leaves only one role for you. You're the villain. You're just a guy who's on that show telling Jenny that she's wrong, that vaccines don't cause autism. I mean, she knows what causes autism. Vaccines, you don't. She has a variety of cures for autism. You don't. And it's just, it's a loser. I think, and just to be completely politically incorrect, it's really hard to get on a show in front of 100% women in the audience and, you know, tell Jenny that she's wrong and that Oprah was wrong to have her on the show. It's just not a winning formula there for us guy scientists.
Right. So among your lessons is avoid debating celebrities. So you followed your advice there. But you point out that even saying things that are scientifically accurate can still cause regret. Has that happened to you a lot?
Yeah. I think the thing where it happened to me the most was I was asked, you know, how many vaccines a child could theoretically respond to, giving the number of circulating white blood cells in your body, the kind of so-called B cells in your body, which are the kind of cells that make antibodies, and knowing how many cells that were there, no matter how many different parts of viruses or bacteria, evoke an antibody response. I mean, how many could you respond to? And so I worked with actually a theoretical immunologist at Wistar, the Wistar Institute, which is where I trained, which is a research institute in Philadelphia, a guy named Andy Caton, and he sort of directed me to a couple theoretical immunologists at UCAL San Diego, and we sort of worked through this, and I think a conservative number is about 10,000. You could probably respond to about 10,000 vaccines. Now, this may sound outlandish, and certainly the visual image is awful, but when you think that, you know, we have really 10 to the 14th bacteria on the surface of our bodies, you know, which is about 100 trillion bacteria, to which we respond and make grams of antibodies every day, it shouldn't be a surprising number. But I regret saying it. I mean, I became, you know, the person who thinks children should get 10,000 vaccines, guys. It's a hideous, monstrous image. And I just, you know, often hear it from people. And once I had to give a talk to a group of journalists in the suburban Philadelphia, and somebody said to me, you know, well, you know, he had read that I had actually gotten 10,000 vaccines. And what did that feel like? And I told him actually that wasn't true. He said that he'd read it on the Internet. I told him that the Internet isn't always right, but so it's always seems to have haunted me. I guess the lesson there was, you know, one could have just reasonably said our immune systems are vigorous and broad, and you can respond to many things without putting a number on it. But because I'm an immunologist, so, you know, you sort of choose to put a number on that and then hurt yourself.
But this is the issue with scientists, isn't it? I mean, you want to give an answer that is backed up by quality data, and so it involves giving some of the data, at least a little bit of it, a hint of it.
Yeah, no, the purpose was to show you how that really in the scheme of things that what we the immunological challenges we get in vaccines really are not just figuratively but literally a drop in the ocean of which you encounter and manage every day. That was really the purpose of that, but it sort of came back to haunt me. I mean, I don't know if you can sort of look on the Internet and see how that is often the phrase that people assign to me. He's the guy who thinks you should get 10,000 vaccines, but, you know, what can you do?
Right. A couple of emails here. Sam, No Town Given, writes, I find it interesting and no less paradoxical that the myth that vaccines were responsible for causing autism was actually falsely promoted by a British doctor, in caps, and an exclamation point. I'd like to hear your guests comment on this. That's from Sam.
Yeah, no, and so it was born of a researcher named Andrew Wakefield, who believed that that the MMR vaccine sort of affected the intestine, and that sort of allowed for the entrance of brain damaging proteins, for which he had no evidence. And the paper was really just a case series. It wasn't a study of anything. It was just eight children who'd gotten this vaccine, and then within a month of getting the vaccine, developed signs or symptoms of autism. Really, it was no different than having a paper of children who, say, had autism that within the previous month had eaten a peanut butter sandwich. It was really that quality of paper. But it did spark a firestorm, and, you know, certainly now I think 17 studies have looked at his hypothesis and shown that it was wrong. But it's hard to undo that. It's really hard to... It's easy to scare people. It's much harder to unscare them. Once you've brought that notion up into their head, you know, then it's it's just hard to make it go away. It's why then that happens in court all the time, right? Where someone will, a lawyer will say something knowing that there's going to be an objection, knowing that the judge is going to say strike that, and I'm asking the jury to disregard that, but you can't make it leave your head. And that's what happens here. There's no story like no story. You know, you'd much rather have no story than have a story that says, you know, that vaccines don't cause autism, because then what suddenly you're thinking, wait, vaccines could cause autism? That's true? Well, then maybe I shouldn't vaccinate my children.
Oh, wow. An email from Lee in Eugene asks, what about the inclusion of formaldehyde and other substances that normally we've never put into our bodies, in vaccines, in other words?
Right. Well, first of all, formaldehyde is a product of single carbon metabolism. We have had formaldehyde in our bloodstream ever since we crawled out of ocean onto land. So formaldehyde is in your body, and it levels far greater than you would ever see when it's used as an inactivating agent in vaccines. So, for example, formaldehyde is used to inactivate polio, the polio virus, so that it could, we basically eliminated polio from this country. And it's at levels that are, again, one would consider trace, and certainly far less than you have in your circulating in your bloodstream at any one time. But you're right. I mean, people, that's a perfect example, right? You hear the word formaldehyde and you think, you know, preserving dead bodies. I mean, why are we doing this? But again, it's the best example, Penn and Teller did something once where they sort of went around to a group of people in California and trying to get them to sign a petition to ban dihydroxy monoxide from the face of the earth. You know, two hydrogen atoms, one oxygen atom, water. And so they got 300 signatures. So this was California, so you know, maybe that doesn't count. But, 300 people basically to ban water from the face of the earth by giving it a chemical name. You know, the DuPont used to have an advertising campaign, Better Living Through Chemistry. Yeah, they dropped that, you know,
right,
because some of the term chemical is a bad term, even though we're all made of chemicals.
Becca in Lane County writes, most people just don't trust studies. I don't know how we'll solve this.
I don't know how we're going to solve it either. I mean, I do think scientists generally are regarded fairly highly. I mean, certainly we seem to beat out lawyers and business executives and politicians, but I'm not sure that says much. But in any case, I do think, you know, we just have to be better at explaining what studies are. I mean, how, you know, I think when Andrew Wakefield, you could argue the best thing he did, the most benign interpretation of what he did, was he raised a question. Did MMR vaccine cause autism? That is an answerable question. You're not asking how many angels can dance on the head of a pin here. You're saying, you know, are you more likely to get autism if you got the vaccine? If you're not, you can look at hundreds of thousands of people, as was done, to show you aren't any more likely to do that. And so it is frustrating to get people to understand and believe in studies. But, you know, it's interesting. Science isn't a belief system. It's an evidence-based system. You know, religion is a belief system. You have to believe that, you know, that Moses parted the Red Sea, or that Jesus raised Lazarus after he was dead for a few days. I mean, that's a belief system. This is an evidence-based. You don't have to – I think that's Neil deGrasse Tyson's point, you know, which is you don't have to believe in science.
Right. That's true. Science will take care of itself. There's a really interesting three-word phrase early in the book: culture shapes knowledge. And it made me think about the way we mix up science and entertainment, but there's also politics and entertainment. So we seem to cross over all the things in our culture and get this mishmash in which we don't really know who to believe.
You're right. It's, you know, you have on the one hand good information. I mean, there is good information. There are certain truths that do emerge. I mean, evolution is a fact. Gravity is a fact. Climate change is a fact. So those are facts. And then you have this on the other side, you have people who you would like to understand those facts. But in order to do that, there is this window, this sort of opaque window that you have to try and get through to get people to understand it. And that window is made opaque by the culture, which includes sort of the entertainment notion of getting information out there. And there are people who are far more entertaining than scientists, like celebrities or politicians or activists, who are sort of politically motivated and are motivated for other reasons. And they're better at it. They're just better at it. I mean, it's just really frustrating to me how I think we can do better as scientists. The American Academy for the Advancement of Science is located in Washington, D.C. It has 120,000 members. That should be a sales force who gets out there, leaves the lab, and starts to talk. Because believe me, I mean, I was funded for 25 years by the National Institutes of Health to work on understanding rotavirus that ultimately led to a vaccine. I mean, who paid my salary? It was the taxpayer that paid my salary. It was the voter that paid my salary. And they can just as easily decide not to pay it. I mean, science is a privilege. It's not a right. And we could just as easily lose that privilege if we, if we don't really try and explain why what we're doing is important.
But you know, we're at a period in history too where it's not necessarily what is being put out there, but as we point out, in the hands of celebrities, politicians, whatever, it's who is saying it. And then we're reaching a point. I noticed recently, within the last couple of months, and it may have been going on for a lot longer, it's just when I noticed it, but that people are starting to criticize Snopes for being left wing.
I'm sorry, criticize who for being left-wing?
Snopes.com, which is a big Mythbusters.
Oh, right.
Check up to see if an internet hoax is a hoax or
right,
not.
Right, right. No, it's a great site, right? I mean, they back up what they say with data. And so, I mean, I use that site as a source for, some of the urban myths you hear. Is that real or not real? I'm always disappointed to find out it's not real, by the way. But, it's those are great sites, right? And so that's it. We're so tribal. We're just very quick to point to anything that we choose not to believe as being somehow motivated by something else or somehow controlled by some evil force.
You talk about debates. You avoid debates with celebrities, but Bill Nye went there with creationist Ken Ham, and I wonder if you cringed watch that. And then, but he said, Bill Nye felt like he couldn't duck because he would have looked cowardly. I wonder what you think about that aspect of it.
Yeah, that's a great question. The question is, should you debate the undebatable, independent of whether it's with a celebrity or not? Should you debate the undebatable? I mean, something that's scientifically not debatable. Should you debate whether or not the Holocaust happened? Should you debate whether or not evolution is real? Should you debate whether or not homeopathy is contains actual medicine? Should you debate those things, or are you simply just giving oxygen, just giving a platform, giving respect to a side that really doesn't deserve any of those things? And I've sort of come around on that. I think you should. I think that when Bill Nye, the science guy, chose to debate Ken Ham at the Creation Museum, in Petersburg, Kentucky, which features a diorama when you walk in of a dinosaur standing next to a small child, where those two groups missed each other by about 65 million years, you have to really give him credit for standing up in clearly what was not a home court and talking and debating that. But what he did, what Bill Nye did, although he wasn't going to convince Ken Ham, who was head of that museum, he wasn't going to convince him. He wasn't necessarily going to convince the audience, but millions of people saw that on YouTube and certainly learned a lot.
All right, so they get to know that there is another side out there for sure. The book is called Bad Advice, or Why Celebrities, Politicians, and Activists Aren't Your Best Source of Health Information. It's the work of Paul Offit, professor of pediatrics at the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, director of the Vaccine Education Center there. Paul, always a pleasure. Thanks again.
Thank you, Jeffrey.